Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jeff Woolsey. I'm a Principal Program Manager Lead in the Windows Server and Cloud Division. It's certainly a pleasure to be here in Amsterdam. It's my first time in Amsterdam, and it's a pleasure to be here for TechEd Europe. We've had a great day. We've already started the keynote kickoff. Hopefully you were there. We showed off a couple of really cool things, and today we're going to dig deeper into what's new in Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. A couple of things we're going to cover: scale up workloads. What are the things that we had to do to design? For example, I showed 64 virtual processors today, talked about VMs with huge amounts of memory, up to a terabyte of memory and within a virtual machine. I also showed a pretty astounding performance of a million IOPS from a single virtual machine. That doesn't come for free. There's a significant amount of engineering work. It's not trivial by any means to achieve this performance and scale. So I want to give you a little bit of insight into some of the work that we had to do to make this just happen. I'm going to talk briefly about platform resiliency, talk a little bit about storage, automation, manageability. I also may have a little surprise here, something you probably haven't heard about. One thing I want to make sure you're very clear is we cannot cover everything. Normally, I will actually do this in a two-part session, and even in doing two parts back-to-back, I still can't get through everything, not even close. We could pretty much sit here all day, and we barely still scratch the surface. So please take advantage of the hands-on labs, all of the breakout sessions, and please make sure you're going to TechNet and MSDN as well, because we're going to continue to add more and more to what's coming in Server 2012 and Hyper-V. So, first of all, really quickly, before I dive in, I've got to mention one thing, because I've been working on virtualization in cloud for a very, very long time. And I don't know how many times I've had the conversation with someone who says, we've got cloud. We've got something that manages kind of high level, but we know we've got a lot of VMs, so we've got cloud. And it's very, very obvious in talking with folks that a lot of people really don't understand that cloud and virtualization, sometimes people seem to think they're exactly the same, but there really is a difference between the two. When I think about virtualization, I think about virtualization as where were we, and the problem we were trying to solve was server consolidation. If you look back in the 90s, the answer to every problem was, well, just go buy another server. Just go plug in another server. They're easy to configure. They're easy to set up. They're relatively inexpensive, and we had servers coming out our ears. And in the first part of the 2000s and the aughts, what happened was we started to pay for that. People realized, look, I got servers everywhere. And in fact, while I still have the budget to buy them, I have no place to put them, and I have no power to power them with. So virtualization came along as a way to consolidate those and dramatically improve the efficiency of the servers that you own, reduce the physical footprint, and reduce the power footprint. That's all goodness. However, the management paradigm didn't change. What happened was I had a physical server here, and I had a physical server here, and I converted them, I magically converted them into a virtual machine, but guess what? I'm managing the same way. If I need more memory, I go to this VM, and I give it more memory. If I need more storage or more networking, I go to this VM, and I give it more networking and more storage. That's how you know you're doing virtualization. If the management paradigm is that's what you're doing, you're living in the virtualization world. And what we really want to do is we want to provide resilience, we want to provide that scalability and elasticity so that the services themselves can automatically expand and contract. To do that is more than just a virtualization layer. And this is something I've seen for years. People focus on the virtualization layer, the hypervisor, the platform. And don't get me wrong, this is where I live. I love virtualization layer. I love the hypervisor, okay? But at the same time, if that's all you're looking at, you're missing the big picture. Very often people will come to Microsoft, they'll come to, we'll have briefings with customers, and I'll ask a very simple question. How many virtualization hosts do you have in your infrastructure? And the gentleman sitting at the end of the table, usually a CXO, CTO, very high up, will say, we've got about 250 virtualization servers. Guy sitting next to him says, actually, sir, we've got about 500. And then the guy at the end of the table, who's actually running the service, says, well, actually, we have about 850. And they can't even answer the most basic question about their infrastructure. Well, if you can't tell me how many virtualization hosts or how many VMs you have with any certainty, how do you know that you're running your business most efficiently? How didn't you know that your workloads are actually getting the best performance? That if you work in a regulated industry, if you work for the government, for the military, for healthcare, how do you know that you're meeting compliance? You've got to have a comprehensive management solution in place. So while I'm going to spend a ton of time talking about what we're doing at the platform layer, I also want to make sure people understand you've got to look at it from the systems management layer. And for us, when we talk about the hybrid cloud, it really is about providing the capabilities that we have in Windows Azure, Office 365, Intune. It's also about enabling the hybrid cloud with service providers. And let me be very clear. We have put in a whole bunch of new features in Server 2012 that almost exclusively are for service providers. I'll give you a perfect example. Network virtualization. Maybe some enterprises will adopt it. There are a number of reasons why. But if you're a service provider, this is absolute bread and butter for you. This is exactly what you need to take your business to the next level. It's solving one of the biggest problems we have in the industry today, which is how do I deal with multi-tenant isolation on my networks? We're putting that in the box. That's something specifically for network service providers. So when we look at the cloud, we look at public, we look at those common technologies that provide the hybrid, identity, virtualization, management, and development. And when I talk about private cloud, it's not server. It's server and system center. I always want to be clear about that because I get people that come by and they say, hey, I've got Hyper-V, so I've got cloud. And I'm like, well, you've got the makings of the cloud. You've got the platform layer. But if you really want cloud, it's about having comprehensive management that can manage not only the virtual machines, but can manage those workloads, those applications, and do that in a comprehensive fashion. And we look at this very broadly. We don't look at it as, here's a VM, let's go manage that. We don't look at it as, here's a VM in an application. We look at it much more broadly than that. You saw Brad in the keynote today talk about managing all sorts of devices, whether it's tablets, whether it's phones, whether it's PCs, whether it's servers, yes. Whether it's client applications, whether it's server applications, yes. We look at things much more broadly than that. So, building your cloud just got a lot easier with Windows Server 2012. So let me tell you about some of the cloud considerations we got from you, we got from the industry, and from our own learnings in running the largest data centers around the world. And we spent over a year in what we call a pre-planning process. We spent over $10 million in just no coding, talking with you, wanting to understand how do we build you the best cloud OS. So a number of considerations. Number one, I talked about this earlier. We want to be able to virtualize those workloads considered non-virtualizable, mission-critical scale-up workloads. Very often we talk with customers and say, look, we love Hyper-V and 2008 R2 today, and we're using it to virtualize a good chunk of a huge majority of our workloads. But over here in the corner, I've got this really big SQL server. This SQL server has dozens of cores, hundreds of gigabytes of memory. It's got multiple fiber channel adapters configured with MPIO for redundancy. It's got multiple 10-gig NICs in there for LBFO, for resiliency. That thing's been sitting on the metal, and that's staying on the metal until you can prove to me that I can actually virtualize it. Okay, we hear you. That's a challenge we had to meet. Storage. We want to make sure that we can provide you lots of choice, lots of flexibility, and reduce the cost of storage. We know this from running our own data centers. Storage can be a very, very big cost. It also can be very, very complex. And there's a lot of reasons and a lot of choices why you want to use file-based, SAN-based, or direct-attached storage. So when someone says, what should I use? I want to be able to say, well, let's use what meets your needs. Let's use what makes business sense for you. Continuous availability. We look throughout the entire stack, and we wanted to make sure that we delivered continuous availability through every part of the stack, and I'll show you exactly how we've done that. VM mobility. This is one of your favorite topics. One of the things that we talked with customers about was people love live migration. And they said, we love it, we want more of it, give us everything you can. And when you think you've done that, give us even more. We love mobility. Okay, we heard you loud and clear on that. Networking, huge pain point for enterprises, for large customers, for example, large enterprises that go out and buy another company through a merger and an acquisition, or many mergers and acquisitions. I talked to one company that in the last 3 years had bought 12 different companies. I said, wow, business must be good. But at the same time, they were also dealing with, how do we rationalize 12 different networks? How do we make this work? Because we do want to consolidate the data centers. We want to consolidate this infrastructure. But we're going to need to hire someone with a PhD in networking to figure out how to make this work. How do we provide a solution for that? Service providers would tell us, honestly, networking is a huge pain point for us. We want people to move to the cloud. We want to make it easy for them to onboard into our data centers. And right now, we can't even solve some of the most basic fundamental problems, which is, look, this customer wants to come in with 10.0.0.1. So does this customer. In fact, everybody in this room wants to come into my hosting service, and they all want to use 10.0.0.1. And I'm already using 10.0.0.1. So now I have to go tell them to go re-IP all of their workloads. That's no fun. No one wants to have that conversation, because that conversation usually doesn't end well. It usually ends up with someone walking out of the room saying, well, I'm not going to go re-IP all my workloads. Thanks for playing. So how do we solve those types of challenges? So let's start with scale up. Scale isn't just more virtual processors. I bring this up because I've gotten this question for a long, long time. Server 2008 R2, Hyper-V, when do I get more than 4 virtual processors? Give me 8 and everything will be magically good. Well, actually, no, it won't be magically good. There's actually a reason. There's a bunch of engineering work you have to do to actually make scale work really well. And I'll explain that in a minute. Live migration should just work. If you're going to give me these big honking virtual machines, and you're going to give me a whole new bunch of new capabilities, that's great. But you cannot take away live migration. This was very clear. One thing we ask customers over and over again, here's shiny new feature X. I'm not even going to tell you what the feature is. It's a really cool feature. But if I give you this feature, this virtual machine can't move anymore. It's locked to this piece of hardware. You can't fail it over. You can't live migrate it. You can't storage migrate it. It is locked to this piece of hardware. How do you feel about feature X? And the answer from the customers always was, I want you to take feature X. I want you to shoot it and bury it in the backyard, and I never want you to talk about it again. Because I always want to be able to move a VM. We heard you loud and clear on that one. Performance must increase with cores. Now, I have to admit, this one sounds silly to me, too. Because, of course, you want performance to increase with cores. Why wouldn't you? Well, of course you do. You expect that. And, in fact, if I just give you more virtual processors and your performance plateaus, or worse, goes down, you're not going to be really happy with that either. So we need to maximize your investment. And again, we want to virtualize those workloads considered non-virtualizable. So let's start with a fundamental concept. Before I even get to the virtual, let's talk about physical for just a second. NUMA, or non-uniform memory access. The reason why this came up is back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, as we started to get to SMP machines as more popular on x86, what was happening was we had multiple processors trying to perform I/O to devices. And maybe it was memory, maybe it was storage, maybe it was devices on the bus. But they were all sharing that same bus. And the problem is there's a lot of contention, even with two processors. And this is before hyper-threading. This is before cores. This is literally two processors, single-threaded processors in a system, all this contention. It was a huge problem. And they realized, we got to fix this. And so NUMA came out as a way to help hosts and physical machines scale up. And the way it works is you create what we call NUMA nodes. And in a NUMA node is essentially a grouping of memory and processors. And the reason why you do this is because you want to be able to provide the best locality for CPU accesses, memory accesses, because there's a latency and there's a performance penalty if you have to jump across what we call NUMA nodes. So high-performance applications, SQL, Exchange, or scale-up workloads, they will detect they're running on a NUMA-aware system, and they will make sure that as they perform CPU and thread allocations, they do it with best locality. Now, this may sound like some super high-end feature, but NUMA is something that's been gradually becoming more pervasive, and in fact, you probably have workloads in your environment you don't even know that are NUMA aware. And in Server 2012, we have a great new example in IaaS. IaaS in Server 2012 for the first time is NUMA aware, and we've seen some massive performance improvements, massive scalability improvements, because the fact that we're now projecting IaaS is now NUMA aware. So because of this, that's how it worked on physical. We wanted to make sure that as we started to build these virtual machines with not just 4 virtual processors, not even 8, but 16, 24, 32, 48, 64 virtual processors, you have to make sure that the virtual machine is NUMA aware inside the virtual machine. So let me show you what good NUMA looks like. This kind of makes it easier to understand. This is what good NUMA looks like. This is optimal. Memory allocation and thread allocations are all occurring within the same NUMA node. You can see that memory is populated in all of the NUMA nodes. 1, 2, 3, and 4 all have 4 DIMMs in there, and you can see all of the processors and all of the memory is communicating within each NUMA node. Here's what bad NUMA looks like. This is, the system is imbalanced. You can see that each NUMA node has a different amount of memory. Memory allocations and thread allocations, thus, have to cross NUMA boundaries. You can see there's actually multiple node hops. And if you look at NUMA node 2, it actually has an odd number of DIMMs. So if you're using memory interleaving, there's an additional performance penalty you may be paying as well if you're not taking advantage of interleaving. NUMA node 3 doesn't have enough memory. And in the worst possible situation, NUMA node 4 has no local memory. So every time it goes to perform a memory access, it's a remote hop. It's got to traverse a NUMA boundary. Now, before we had on-chip memory controllers and you had to traverse the front side bus, this was even worse. It was a lot worse. It got better as we moved memory controllers onto the processor, but still, it's something you really, really want to avoid to get the best possible performance. So this is how it's applied in the physical world. Let me show you how we apply it in the virtual world with guest NUMA. So what we do is we present a NUMA topology within the virtual machine. And the good news is we do all the hard work for you. When you create the virtual machine, we look at the underlying physical topology, and we make sure that we create an intelligent virtual machine that maps to the corresponding resources on the physical machine. The reason why is because when you start installing applications in your VM, SQL, IIS, any of your NUMA-aware applications, and they start to make determinations about NUMA locality, thread locality, CPU locality, you want it to map to the underlying physical resources. The guest NUMA nodes are aligned with host resources by default. You don't need to do anything. You basically say, look, how many processors do I want in this VM? I want 16 processors. Great. We'll do all the hard work for you. Now, just in case you're wondering, yes, we also put the knobs and buttons in there too. So if you decide you think you want to go tweak with the NUMA topology, you think you're smarter than us, we have the expert advanced knobs in there as well, and you can go in there and tweak the NUMA topology. I will say, one of the things we learned at the beta was a lot of you guys had fun tweaking those knobs, but then didn't realize, well, I think my performance got worse because you probably tweaked it in not the right way. That's okay. We have a nice big reset button now. So feel free to play with it to your heart's content. Enjoy it. Try it out. If you think you're in a bad spot, don't worry about it. Hit the hardware reset button. We will then look down at the physical topology, remap, do all of the remapping of NUMA for you, and it's all covered. So you can't get yourself in a bad state. In terms of scale, if you look at where we've come in just a couple of releases, you can see between Server 2008, 2008 R2, and Server 2012, we have just really knocked the doors off scalability. 320 logical processors, just to give you an understanding of how big a machine that is, that's a 16-socket server. Each socket has 10 cores, and then you enable symmetric multithreading. That's a really big box. 4 terabytes. I can't even remember how much that cost, but I'm pretty sure it's over $250,000 just for the memory. 64 nodes. Massive scale in terms of clustering. In terms of virtual machine processors, 64 virtual processors. And up to 1 terabyte of memory. No taxes here. So please, populate your servers with as much memory as you like. The whole point of it is to give you the best performance, the best scale, and the best density, and we want to give you the best Cloud OS to do that. I'm kind of sneaking ahead of myself here, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyways. Take a look at live migration and live storage migration. So in Server 2008 R2, you can live migrate one VM at a time. In 2012, you can live migrate as many as you want at a time. There is no limit in Hyper-V. The only limit is how much hardware you want to provide. If you've got a single gigabit NIC, maybe I can do 2, maybe I can do up to 4 at a time. If I've got 10 gigabit, maybe I can do 10, maybe I can do 12. If I've got teamed 10 gigabit, I've got 2 of these, maybe I can do 24 of these at a time. I can tell you, I was talking with one of our test leads, and we've actually live migrated 40 VMs simultaneously with Server 2012. So let me tell you right now, not only are you investing in a platform now, but we're ready for you even down the road as you upgrade your infrastructure. So the limit is only how much hardware you want to provide. Live storage migration, now and in the box. And again, you can perform as many live storage migrations as you want, limited only by the hardware you provide. There's 32 virtual processors. Took that on Server 2008 R2. By the way, there is 32 virtual processors in CentOS. Let me be very clear as well. You saw Mark Rusinovich, and if you saw the Azure keynote demo this morning, you saw that we had a number of Linux distributions running on Azure. And Hyper-V, guess what? We've been doing Linux for a very, very long time. We've got support for Red Hat. We've got support for CentOS. We've got support for SUSE. We've got support for NeoKylin. And if you go and download the current version of Ubuntu, guess what? It installs on Hyper-V. All of the drivers are there. You don't even need to even install any tools. So we've been making a tremendous investment in making sure that Linux runs really, really great on Hyper-V. So be very clear, we're about providing the best Cloud OS. By the way, here's 64 virtual processors, and this is also on 2008 R2. The reason I showed this is I want to make sure people understand that 64 virtual processors works down level as well. It's not something that requires Server 2012. If your OS supports it, we've made sure that we implemented 64 VPs in an industry standard fashion. In terms of storage, storage in and of itself is a multi-hour talk. In fact, one of the PMs over here for storage is doing an excellent session later. I'll point you to his session in just 1 second. A couple things about your input on storage. Number one, leverage the storage array capabilities. If I've spent 5, 6, 7 digits on a big SAN array, please, please use it as much as possible. Take advantage of all those offload capabilities. You saw that today in the demo. If you saw me do the ODX demo this morning, I copied over 1 gigabyte per second. When's the last time you saw that? Okay, copying a 10 gigabyte file in 10 seconds. Well, that's because we're taking advantage of the capabilities in the underlying storage platform, something you specifically asked for. Native access to SANs from VMs. Remember earlier when I mentioned that big honkin' SQL Server box over here sitting in the corner? And one of the reasons why people want to virtualize it may not be memory support or core support, but I need native fiber channel access to the SAN. That could be something that limits people from moving to a virtualized world. Help reduce the cost of storage. So today, we can do live migration with block storage, but people want to be able to do it on lower cost storage, or in fact, not even shared storage at all. Wouldn't it be great if I could live migrate using just direct attached storage? And then highly scalable virtual disks. We want to make sure that everybody's talking about big data. We want to make sure that our underlying virtual disk format is never a blocker for virtualization. So you're going to see I've got a couple of these in the bottom right-hand corner. You're going to see that I've got these on a number of my slides here, because literally, again, these are talks in and of themselves, and I'd highly recommend checking these out if these are of interest to you. Hyper-V over SMB, which is going to talk about some of our major investments in making remote file storage server work with Server 2012, and a deep dive into Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V storage. A couple things. I'm just going to touch on this. Number one, live storage migration. You want to move a virtual machine storage around from one subsystem to another? In the box, included. You want to get this from the other guys? You're going to go have to buy Enterprise Super Special Plus Edition at $3,500 per proc. We're just including this in the platform. Virtual fiber channel. One of the things we want to be able to do is, like I said, virtualize those workloads considered non-virtualizable. One way to do it is to give those VMs first-class access to the SAN. Support for file-based storage on SMB3. Again, literally this is easily an hour talk, if not two to three. Jose Barreto, this guy is just, the file system team have done a tremendous job, and he does an awesome presentation on what we're doing with file-based storage in SMB3. But this is about reducing the cost of storage. About, look, maybe I need a SAN, but maybe there are plenty of reasons why I don't need a SAN. And it's easy for this to become a religious debate about file-based storage versus block-based storage. I prefer not to get into that debate. I look at it a little bit differently. Look at all of the workloads in your infrastructure. I look at it as a very simple question. Do all of the workloads in your infrastructure require a SAN? That's the way I look at it. If the answer is yes, go for it. 99 times out of 100, though, the answer is not really no. In fact, many times I'll talk to folks and say they bought a SAN. I'll say, great, what's on there? Well, my CRM, my SQL, my web, my file, my print servers. I'm like, whoa. Why your print servers? Why are your print servers on your most expensive storage that you purchased? Why is that? Well, we bought the SAN with all this capacity, and we just thought we'd use it. And I'm just, okay. That's one way to look at it, I guess. But wouldn't you rather make sure that that is there for those high-performing scale-up workloads? And what if I could give you a better or different option at a much lower price point with a file server that gives you SAN-like capabilities like thin provisioning, trim, unmap, deduplication? Doesn't that sound interesting? Yes, it does. So we made huge investments on making sure that Hyper-V supports SMB storage. And then there's the new VHDX format, which I mentioned earlier, gets us up to 64 terabytes per virtual disk. And I always say per virtual disk because I've had a number of people say, that's per VM, right? I'm like, no. That's per disk. And we support over 255 virtual disks per VM. So you're going to run out of physical storage long before you run out of virtual storage. It's pretty much unlimited at this point. By the way, if that's not enough storage, please come on up and talk to me. I'd like to know what you're doing. Native 4K disk support and online meta operations. If you use our snapshotting capabilities in Hyper-V in the past, it's a very powerful capability, but it required downtime to merge those snapshots. Not anymore. All that is live now. Merging of snapshots just happens without any downtime. Very cool, very seamless. I showed you ODX support earlier today in the keynote. Just tremendous capability in terms of performance and scale. And briefly, let me explain what ODX is doing. So as I talked about in the keynote this morning, generally the way Windows has worked in the past, if I'm doing just a file copy, how does that work? Well, I read from the source and write to the destination. Read from the source, write to the destination. And the server performs all of these actions, and it will make sure that everything gets over there. It will be proper, and it'll happen. It'll take some time, but eventually, I've copied everything from one location to the next. In Server 2012, now it's different. Server goes to storage and say, by the way, do you support ODX? The storage comes back and says, why, yes, I do. Great. Here's a token. Please, perform this copy, and give me status updates while you're doing it. Okay. So instead of the server performing the reading and writing, the array is actually doing the copy. The server, there's no I/O between the server and the array. It's happening securely. And in fact, on the array side, it could be literally moving pointers. So instead of actually copying multiple terabytes of data, it could be saying, no, here are the pointers, you're done. Something that could literally take hours or even days can be done in minutes, if not seconds. It's a powerful new capability. It's also standards-based. We did this work. We took it to the standards bodies. It's been ratified, and we're working with every storage vendor out there. And one key point I want to make is if you're looking at buying a new storage platform, make sure it has ODX. If it doesn't have ODX, stop the conversation and say, please show me your ODX systems. And I can tell you every storage vendor out there we've been working with is jumping all over ODX. Very powerful capabilities. I showed you copying this morning, but what's great about ODX is it's inherently part of Server 2012. Hyper-V just magically uses it. When it's there, we take advantage of it. For example, creating fixed disks. Today, when you create a fixed disk, how do we do it? Well, say I need to create a 10 gigabyte fixed disk. What do? We create a single file. It's 10 gigabytes. We zero the whole thing out. And that zeroing is what takes quite a bit of time. In fact, I asked the storage guys, on a standard desktop laptop, how long does this take? And they said it takes about 3 minutes. I said, great. How long does this take on an ODX system? And they said, oh, come on over. Let me show you. He said, Jeff, by the way, don't blink. You may miss it. Click done. Something that used to take 3 minutes is done in less than half a second. That's the power of ODX. So that's creating a fixed disk. But we also use it for dynamically expanding our VHDs. We also use it for merging disks. We also use it for live storage migration. So if you're live storage migrating and you've got ODX, we will just transparently take advantage of it. And if ODX isn't there, then we just fall back to the way we've always done it. So it's really a win-win for everyone. And again, huge, huge changes over the last couple of releases. Live storage migration now in the box. Again, just simply part of Server 2012. We now support file storage on SMB, guest fiber channel, virtual disk support, up 32 times more than anyone else in the industry. You can now guest cluster via iSCSI and or fiber channel. Native 4K disk support, VHD merge, new parents, all of these capabilities simply included as part of the platform. So one thing that gets very interesting is we talk about cloud, and inevitably it gets to this question. Jeff, I like what's going on with cloud. I get it. I want to be able to pool my resources, whether it's storage, whether it's networking, memory, compute, and I want to be able to use them most efficiently. I get it. I love this idea. But there's something that really keeps me up at night. It's about securing that data at rest. In fact, if I take kind of all of the questions that I've received, I can kind of boil it down to this one. Jeff, I've got great, good processes in place, but what other safeguards can I use to protect my data? For example, listen, I make sure that I hire only the best people. I work in a highly regulated industry, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, government, military. We do background checks. We only hire the best people. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about the whoops moment where I have an inadvertent data leakage and something goes out the side door and it was really, really important data. Let me give you a couple examples. One, this is a U.S. power company. They have good processes in place to either physically destroy their drives or scrub them to U.S. Department of Defense standards. And what happens is they bought a whole bunch of new servers, and their old servers go to a third party to dismantle them, to destroy them, and maybe to possibly resell some of the parts like the disks after they scrub them. And so they degauss the disks, or they overwrite the data with a minimum of 3 specified patterns according to the DoD. Well, unfortunately, in this case, the data on those drives simply didn't go through the process. There wasn't a bad guy involved. There was nothing malicious. It was, we thought we went through the degaussing process. We thought we went through the process to overwrite the data, and it didn't happen. And they ended up being sold on eBay. Customer information, credit card information, billing information, confidential employee information, confidential emails. According to Gartner, about a third of companies use outside firms to dispose of PCs and servers. So this is definitely a real scenario. Every so often, someone will say, ah, yeah, Jeff, but we're better than that. That won't happen to us. We've got more defensive measures in place. Okay, here's one that just happened. This is HIPAA. Stolen hard drives. A large medical provider just a few months ago is paying $1.5 million to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Now, their argument was, look, we shouldn't have to pay anything. Yeah, there was a theft of 57 hard drives, and yes, it contained protected health information. for over 1 million individuals. How would you like your medical information, all of your personal, most personal information, just out there for anybody to get to? Well, they said, look, we secured this. This was secured by security patrols going around the building. This was secured by biometric scanner. This was secured by a key card. This was secured by magnetic locks. And this was secured by keyed locks. We shouldn't be fined for this. We clearly put a whole bunch of security safeguards into place. And the response from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services was, the data got out. You clearly didn't do enough. And in fact, if we could fine you more, we would. Because this is the most private data that people have. 71% of healthcare organizations have suffered at least one data breach within the last year. So we look at this as a very huge problem we want to help solve. Whether you're in healthcare, medical, government, military, you name it. A critical safeguard for the cloud is BitLocker encrypted cluster volumes. This is something we've never had before that we're introducing in Server 2012. We've had BitLocker, and BitLocker works great, but it only worked on direct attached storage. So for example, when the military goes into battle and they take their servers, those servers are encrypted with BitLocker. And if all of a sudden I have to make a hasty retreat, standard operating procedure is to take a grenade, put it on the server, and run that way. Now, if the grenade takes out the server, all is good. If the grenade doesn't take out the server, it's okay. Because even if the bad guys pull out the disk, plug it into another machine, there's only two options. They can type in the BitLocker PIN, or they can format the disk. That's all you can do. Those are your only options. Well, now, we're bringing this to cluster volumes. So now with Server 2012, you can create the biggest, baddest clusters in the industry, 64 nodes, 4,000 virtual machines, but you can now encrypt the cluster volumes. This is really important, because if one of those disks gets out the side door, doesn't matter. All the bad guys can do is format it. Look at those two examples I provided earlier. The disks that were sold on eBay, the disks that were stolen, doesn't matter. That's the kind of safeguard that you're looking for to make sure you're not letting important data leak out the side. BitLocker encrypted cluster volumes integrates with Active Directory, it integrates with clustering, it integrates with group policy, and of course, Hyper-V plugs into all of this. In addition, one of the questions I get asked all the time is, yeah, what about performance though? There's got to be some performance hit. We actually had to put in some special instrumentation to find the performance hit. It's actually 0.001%, so it's essentially free. Who's going to turn down free encryption of their cluster volumes? It's simply a checkbox. It's simply enabled. This is a great solution. You've got to make sure you take a look at this. Again, this is something you have to really consider. If you're developing a private cloud, this should be table stakes. This is absolutely part of the platform and something you should be deploying always. High availability. So your input on high availability was, again, VMs need access to fiber channel SANs. We also have legacy apps that don't support clustering. So yeah, all of our new apps, we make sure that we either develop them as scale-out applications, so there's HA intrinsically in the deployment, or we're using newer applications that are cluster-aware. But we still got a bunch of those older ones over there that really don't understand clustering, and we want to be able to provide some additional HA to those. Please, I've invested in a SAN. Is there a way we can easily integrate SAN snapshotting and SAN replication? Just make it all work. And then highly scalable virtual disks. So what did we do? We said, okay, you got it. That's what you want. That's what you're going to get. Support for the largest clusters in the industry, 64 nodes and 4,000 VMs in a cluster. Look at this next one, cluster-aware updating. This actually, to me, is one of the coolest features that, honestly, we have a challenge in Server 2012. We literally have so many cool features, we're having a difficulty telling you about all of them because there are literally so many of them. This is a perfect example. What is cluster-aware updating? Well, let's think about this for a second. Say you deploy a 16-node cluster. Okay, you're running Hyper-V on all 16 nodes, and you need to patch them. And I'm not talking about the VMs. Okay, because you can always live migrate VMs off, but I want to patch the hosts. Now today, that means, okay, I can go and live migrate the VMs off, take them offline, patch them, bring them up, and it's a manual process. I could do this, and I could probably write some PowerShell and do some automation. We've made this even easier. In Server 2012, we have cluster-aware updating. You literally walk through a wizard and say, hey, you know what? I think I want to patch the cluster the last Friday of every month. Okay, so the last Friday rolls around, and it's 11 p.m. Everyone's long gone, and guess what happens? Node 1 is put into maintenance mode. Automatically, all the VMs are drained. All the patches are installed. It reboots. It goes to Node 2, evacuates all the VMs back off, completely drains all the nodes, installs all the patches, and literally goes through every node in your cluster automatically without user intervention. That's in the box, folks. Okay? That's all part of cluster-aware updating. And if you prefer, if you'd like to be there, great. There's a nice big, hey, let's patch it right now button. So you can sit there and watch it do it as well. So you got them both. But that's a very powerful capability, and I'm not kidding. We literally have so many features, it's difficult for us to even convey these to you because there's so much in the box. Cluster-aware updating is a perfect example of that. Cluster shared volumes, CSV. That's the underlying storage mechanism that we use to provide concurrent access to multiple nodes to simultaneously to storage for Hyper-V. We've made some huge changes in cluster shared volumes. One of the biggest ones is around backup. Today, if you want to backup in Server 2008 R2, you'd have to backup one node at a time to get the best possible performance. In 2012, you can perform, all of your nodes can perform parallel backup simultaneously with absolute best possible performance. And that's because of some changes we made in CSV. Cluster-wide task scheduling, inbox live migration queuing, literally this is a session in and of itself, which is why I urge you to take a look at WSV 430. Cluster Shared Volumes Reborn, a serious deep dive. This is easily an hour or two talk in and of itself. Guest Fiber Channel, one of my definite favorite cool new features in Server 2012. Because again, look at that big SQL box sitting over in the corner. I want to be able to make sure that SQL has full first-class access to my SAN. It's why I bought the SAN, in fact, because I have this big SQL workload. Well, today it's got MPIO, I'm probably doing guest clustering, and I want to make sure that I have first-class access to the SANs. That's exactly what we're delivering in Server 2012 with virtual fiber channel. And let me be clear, this is real fiber channel in the VM. This isn't some faked out fiber channel. This isn't some emulated fiber channel. It's real fiber channel. And there's a couple of key tenets that went along with virtual fiber channel. Number one is we want to make sure that you zone and mask it the same way you zone and mask a physical machine. If you have to zone and mask your VM in a different way than a physical machine, your virtualization provider is doing it wrong. Completely and totally and utterly wrong. The way you do fiber channel is you zone it and mask it exactly the same way. You assign worldwide node names and worldwide port names to your virtual fiber channel. You zone it and mask it in the storage fabric, and lo and behold, it's all there. And what I mean by it's all there, no restrictions. You want to do guest clustering over fiber channel, it's there. You want to do MPIO over fiber channel, it's there. You want to run DSM software from like EMC PowerPath or NetApp's DSM software, it just works flawlessly in a Hyper-V VM. And all of this works with live migration. Because like I told you before, you guys were in charge. And you told us, we want to make sure that no feature ever precludes live migration. And let me tell you, it was a lot of work to make sure that this works flawlessly with live migration. But we did it. So let's take a look at the entire stack. And I want to talk about complete redundancy. Let's start at the very bottom. Windows Hardware Error Architecture, WIA or RAS. Again, here's another example of another feature that is literally one of the hundreds of new features in Server 2012 you'll never hear about in a keynote. It's actually difficult for me even to get it into this session, but it's something we're just doing automatically under the covers. If we get errors, for example, in the hardware, we know how to deal with it, how to recover from it, and how to prevent it from poisoning the system. So let's say, for example, you get bad memory. And your ECC, because you're running in a server, your ECC memory, we're notified that, whoops, there's a bad page here. We go ahead and take a look. Where is that page located? Because the hypervisor knows where all of that memory lives. The hypervisor is notified, oh, that memory hasn't been allocated yet? Great, no problem. We're going to take note of that. We're going to store it off in the BCD store and make sure that we never allocate that memory. So we have quietly and silently just helped protect your server. You'll never know it. You'll never see it. But we just helped you by protecting your system. Now, what if that memory has actually been allocated to a VM? If that memory has been allocated to a VM, hypervisor is notified, and we immediately shoot the VM. VM's gone. VM is taken down. And what we do is we'll send it up. We'll put an event in the event log and make sure you understand. This VM was taken down because we received hardware errors in this address allocation. And the reason why you do that is because you don't want it to poison the system. And poison is the correct analogy. When you get a hardware error, you don't want that to continue because it will affect the rest of the system and eventually hurt your entire system. So the moment we're notified, we shoot the VM, take it down, doesn't affect the rest of your system. Again, we check, we take that address location, we store it off later, and we make sure it's never allocated again, even across reboots. So that's some awesome work we're doing way down in the weeds, down in the hardware error layer. In terms of physical node redundancy, we have failover clustering for unplanned downtime. So if I walk up to a server, yank out the power cable, those VMs will automatically fail over to another node in the cluster without any user intervention. And then we have live migration for planned downtime. We also have I/O redundancy. We have it for networking. Now, with Windows NIC teaming, we have networking LBFO. And in case you're wondering, one of my favorite features about Windows NIC teaming is, quite honestly, it works with whatever NIC you got. Okay? One of the challenges we've seen and you have told us about is you'll buy a server, and the server comes with NIC vendor A on the motherboard, and then you'll go drop in a PCIe card that uses NIC vendor B, and you can't team the two. Well, technically you can, but you won't get support for it. NIC vendor A says, yeah, we don't support you teaming to NIC vendor B, and NIC vendor B says, no, we don't support you teaming to NIC vendor A, and the guy who sold you the server says, yeah, we don't support any of that. So what ends up happening is you have siloed NICs. Well, with Windows NIC teaming, you can team them all, and we'll support you. In fact, I was talking with one of the program managers in networking. He's got a server with 12 different NICs from 12 different vendors, and it all just works. How cool is that? So NIC teaming in the box, MPIO, we've had that in server for a very, very long time. We've now introduced multi-channel SMB. And again, that's covered in another session. Definitely, you want to check out the SMB stuff. But essentially, it gives you redundancy at the SMB layer. Application service failover. So there's a number of things we've done here. So what happens if you're running a guest application and it's not cluster aware? So you've got some older legacy application. Wouldn't it be great if there was a way to track some sort of lightweight health monitoring to track the applications running in a VM that aren't cluster aware so that you could restart the service automatically without having to move a VM, or in fact doesn't even need to do anything with the VM because it's actually happening within the VM? Well, we now have app monitoring in Server 2012 to help you exactly with this issue. So for those older applications, for example, that don't understand clustering, you can now improve the availability for that and provide some lightweight health monitoring. You can do guest clustering now, not only over iSCSI, but with fiber channel. So you've got an additional redundancy layer there. You can also team guests using SRIOV. And SRIOV will be covered in another session, but SRIOV is single root I/O virtualization. At a very super high level, it allows us to essentially map a NIC into a virtual machine. It allows us to get 10 plus gigabits per second into a VM. So for, again, that big massive hunk and SQL server over there that you've got lots of NICs attached to, you're going to care about this a lot. SRIOV is also built into Server 2012, and you can team with it as well. Then if you finally go up to the top of the stack, we've got a great solution here with Hyper-V Replica. Hyper-V Replica is asynchronous, application-consistent, virtual machine replication built into Windows Server 2012. Built into Windows Server 2012, VM replication. So if I want to replicate, say, from Amsterdam to London, no problem. Amsterdam to Paris, no problem. Heck, Amsterdam to Redmond, let's go. Because it's asynchronous, allows us to stretch really far, allows us to do VM replication, and it's included in the box. It's also unlimited, which means you can replicate as much as you want. We don't charge you for every VM that you replicate. We'll let the other guys do that. In addition, we've done a tremendous amount of work with cluster shared volumes to make sure it'll integrate with your storage replication. So, for example, today, if you buy a SAN, very often one of the capabilities in a SAN is they provide synchronous replication, not async. Well, actually, sometimes they do async as well. But you'll buy synchronous, which is their high-end synchronous replication. And one of the things we made sure is cluster shared volumes now just plugs right in to synchronous replication and also works with your VSS snapshots out of the box. So if you look up and down the entire stack, guess what? Not only are you covered, but you're covered in multiple ways on different types of I/O, application, hardware, I/O, and even across clusters and even across data centers and even around the world. This is a huge change and a huge amount of capabilities and that we're delivering in the Server 2012. So now let's get to one of your favorite topics, complete VM mobility. This is the one that you told us about. Please, give us as much mobility as you can and then some. So live migration with HA. This is what we do today. We do this with Server 2008 R2 Hyper-V right now. You create a cluster, you can live migrate VMs around. But with Server 2012, now you can do, again, unlimited live migrations, limited only by the hardware you want to provide. The more hardware, the more bandwidth you give us, the more virtual machines we can live migrate simultaneously. We're now adding support for SMB. So now we can reduce the cost of storage. We can do it on file-based storage. Doesn't need to be on a SAN anymore. And, of course, live storage migration. So now I can move the underlying virtual disks without any downtime. So, for example, I just bought a new SAN, or I want to migrate from my file server to a SAN, or from direct attached storage to whatever. It doesn't matter. It's completely live, and it's in the box. And, again, only by resources. But wouldn't it be great if you could live migrate a VM with nothing but an Ethernet cable? No shared storage, no clusters, no file shares, just an Ethernet cable. This is long considered the holy grail of live migration, which is why we're introducing shared nothing live migration. So let's hop on over to my demo machine here. Couple things. First of all, let me tell you exactly what I'm using, because I get a lot of people say, that looks too cool. How much racks of gear do you have? This is literally two laptops, just so you know. Two laptops. In fact, I'm not even using a switch because we were having so many network problems over here. I'm literally using a crossover cable, okay? I'll even show you. It's purple. All right. So before I get to that, let me show you a couple things in Server 2012. Let me go over here to the virtual SAN manager. And I mentioned this earlier with virtual fiber channel support. So in Server 2012 now, we can create fiber channel SANs. They appear here. And when I go into the VM, we have a new hardware device. So when you go to add hardware, you'll see there's a new device here called the fiber channel adapter. And you literally click on add, and you connect it to your SAN. And you'll see below, you've got worldwide node names, and you've got worldwide port names. Just like you would on a physical machine, you zone it and mask it, and you go to town. And if you want to copy those addresses to the clipboard, we even have a nice easy copy button there. So fiber channels there. And in fact, just to show you what it looks like from within the VM, I'm going to go to Server 2008 R2 SP1. And I've actually specifically chosen this VM because this is a down-level OS. I'm going to go to Device Manager. And you can see, lo and behold, in Device Manager, there is the Microsoft Hyper-V Fiber Channel HBA. So it looks just like a Fiber Channel HBA in the guest OS. So my applications that are looking for a Fiber Channel HBA will see it there, and it works just great. Now, Let me hop on over here, back to the VM for a second, and I want to talk about some of the network settings real quick. A couple things I want to point out. Again, this falls all under the, we literally have so many features, we're trying to figure out how we explain these to you, but there's a couple I wanted to point out. Going back to security for a second, one of the things that we're seeing, I talked about on-disk encryption and being able to make sure we're securing your data at rest. Well, people also want to secure data on the wire. And we're seeing a lot more adoption of IPsec. Well, IPsec is great because you pretty much enable it. It's transparent. There's nothing you have to do application-wise. It's transparent. Now, today, with Server 2008 R2 Hyper-V, we can use IPsec, but we have to do the encryption and decryption in the virtual machine. Now, it's not a tremendous amount of CPU, but if you've got 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 of these, this is all additive. And so that's a bunch of extra CPU cycles you could be doing encrypting and decrypting traffic. So in Server 2012, we actually have IPsec task offload in Hyper-V. So if your NIC supports IPsec task offload, we just transparently use it. You get decryption and encryption for free, and it's on by default. So when you put in the NIC, if it's supported, we'll use it. And if it doesn't, if the NIC, physical NIC doesn't support it, then we'll just do it in software the way we've always done it. But it allows us to take advantage of the latest and greatest hardware. Another thing I want to point out are some of the security features that we've added. Any of you in the room service providers, any of you hosters or anything like that? Well, there's a few of you. Okay. Here's a couple of features. These are definitely important in enterprises, but service providers, you're going to want to take note of these as well. I always like to remind people, the bad guys have a credit card too, okay? There's no reason a bad guy can't go up to Amazon and say, hey, I want a VM, sure, and provision it me with Windows, sure, and then guess what? He puts his own OS, or he pretends to be a router, or he pretends to be a DHCP server. Why? Because he wants to see if he can sniff any traffic. He wants to see if there's some way he can take a peek at what's going up on there in the big cloud. So we wanted to make sure we provided some additional safeguards in the box. So we have DHCP guard. Okay? This actually helps drops DHCP server messages from unauthorized VMs. So an easy way, simple checkbox to make sure that someone can't spoof being a DHCP server. Another one is router guard that drops router advertisements as well. So if you want to make sure someone's not trying to do something and nefarious on your system, guess what? We've got those included as well. We also include port mirroring and monitoring. Over the years, we've been asked many times, generally people ask about promiscuous mode. It's technically not the right thing, but it, essentially what you want to be able to do is you want to see traffic from a specific port. You want to monitor it or mirror it. You can do that here in Hyper-V. So let's get back to migration now. So I'm going to right-click on a VM and click on Move. And you can see I have a couple different options here. I can move the VM. I'm going to just actually move this out of the way so you can see the status over here. I'm going to move the virtual machine, and I'm going to type in the name of the server. And literally, this is server 2. This is server 1. I'm going to copy it on over to server 2, click Next. And now it's going to ask me, do you want to move the entire VM, or would you like to move parts of it to different locations? So think about this for a second. This is actually an extremely powerful feature kind of hidden in plain view. So say, for example, I had a virtual machine that's got three different disks. It's got my boot disk, and it's got two data disks. Now, I can literally live migrate everything to another server and move everything to the same location. But say, you know what, the boot disk, that can be on slow storage. I don't care. Because all the important stuff, my SQL data, is actually on my two data disks. So what I could do is I can actually live migrate the C disk to a slow storage and the two data disks to my fast SAN or SSD storage and do this simultaneously. So you can actually determine multiple targets in a live migration. In this case, I'm just going to keep it real simple because I only have one disk here. I'm just going to move it to a single location. It asks me where. I'm just going to put it in a folder. And I'm going to click Next. And what you're seeing right now is shared nothing live migration. Literally, everything is happening over an Ethernet cable. There's no clustering. There's no shared storage. There's no SANs. There's no SMB. And nobody else has this. This is a huge, huge mobility feature. Let me be very clear why this is a mobility feature. Number one, it's not HA. Okay? If I throw the system on the down, this machine down and shatter it, that VM's done. There's no HA. I haven't enabled clustering. This is not a high availability solution. It's a mobility solution and a very powerful one. Let me tell you why. Today, you set up a cluster, 16 nodes. You put a whole bunch of VMs in there. It gets full. So you set up another cluster. How do you live migrate VMs from this cluster into this cluster? There's no way to do that today on any virtualization platform. What if I want to live migrate VMs into a cluster? Live migrate VMs out of a cluster? Live migrate between clusters? There's no way to do this on any platform. With shared nothing live migration, doesn't matter. I can live migrate in, out, between clusters because there's no shared storage requirement. Another example, I'm in a data center and I've got 1,000 servers and I need to live migrate a VM from server 1 to server 1,000. Well, you're not going to have a 1,000 node cluster. Doesn't matter because, again, there's no shared storage. So I can freely move a VM anywhere without any storage restrictions. I'm in building 43 in Redmond. And just for giggles one night, I live migrated a VM, I'm on the first floor, up to the third floor in the lab. Then I live migrated it down the street to building 42, then down to building 44, then over to building 25, and then back to my office in building 43. All this over the network, went a couple, probably about a mile or two, total round trip. All of this over the network. No shared storage, no SAN requirement. And by the way, it's already done. I didn't even get a chance. Let me tell you exactly how it works. Because people go, come on, that's almost magic. Actually, it seems like it. There's some serious engineering work here. The way shared nothing live migration works is we're taking advantage of numerous technologies that have come to play. So first of all, we take a look at all of the underlying on-disk representation. We look at all of the storage, everything associated with the on-disk representation of the VM, the virtual disks, the configuration file, everything, and we copy those over. And then we put the VM into what we call an I/O mirroring mode, because we want to make sure that as new things are happening, that writes are happening to both locations simultaneously. One thing that's very important to understand is I get people that say, when I'm doing the shared nothing live migration, they go, well, what happens if I cut this cable right in the middle? During the middle of a shared nothing live migration, did I just lose all my data? Of course not. Of course not. It continues to run on the source until everything is moved over and we have started executing on the target. If at any time during the process, cables cut, machine goes down, power goes out, whatever, it always continues to run on the source. When it finally begins executing on the destination, then we actually delete it on the source and continue. So again, the way it works is I'm moving from here to here. We put the VM into an I/O mirroring mode. All of the on-disk representation moves. And then we start to synchronize the memory state. So for example, if this machine has 8 gigs of memory, of that 8 gigabytes, probably only a fraction of it is actually in use. So if 8 gigabytes is there, maybe only 50 or 100 megabytes is actually active in use. OK, great. So we'll move all of the pages over first. We'll keep track of any pages that change. We call those dirty pages. We keep track of those, make sure those go over. When we get that as small as possible, we then move that last bit of state all live. We can do this generally in under a ping. Get it started over here, begin executing over here, delete it on the source. Now, I've just taken an extremely difficult engineering problem and summed it up in about a minute and a half. But let me tell you, the team, I cannot say enough about what the team here to deliver did on this promise. We really wanted to make sure that we gave you what you asked for. And what you asked for was complete VM mobility without any limitations. That's what we're giving you in the box with Server 2012. So that's shared nothing live migration. So time for one more thing. So here's something you probably haven't heard about. In fact, I just kind of announced it very briefly just over at Tech at Orlando, and you're probably really only the second group of people to hear about this. So take a look at Hyper-V for a second. Look at all those features. Look at all those capabilities. Performance, scale, reliability, automation, extensibility, VM replication, world-class performance, world-beating performance, you name it, it's all in there. One of the things that we've done over the years is we've really embraced the scenarios you've asked for, such as interoperability. You've said, you know what, I want to make sure that I choose a platform that I can run all sorts of OSs. Yes, I'm running Windows, but yes, maybe I've got some Red Hat or I've got some CentOS or SUSE. So we heard you, totally made sure that those platforms run great on Hyper-V. However, one of the things you guys mentioned is when I buy Windows Server, for example, I buy Data Center Edition, I buy it so I can run unlimited copies of Windows. In fact, we made that licensing change way back in 2005, long time ago. And honestly, folks love it because that's what we're seeing. Everybody just buy Data Center, and then you get unlimited copies of Windows. However, what happens is people say, listen, I know I can run Linux on Windows Server, but what happens is I'm kind of using one of those imaginary slots because I bought Windows Server for Windows licenses. And what I really would like is I want to be able to run Linux, but I want to be able to run it freely. So wouldn't it be great if we gave you a free hypervisor with all of the capabilities, all of the performance, all of the scale, for free? Announcing Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2012, a completely free enterprise class hypervisor. I know everyone's in shock at the moment, so I'll let y'all take a deep breath. The first stage is shock. The second stage is denial. The third stage is acceptance. And the fourth stage is, Jeff, where's the URL so I can download this thing right now? So let me explain this to you. Hyper-V Server, this is actually going to be our third major release of Hyper-V Server. We've delivered this for many years. And it continues to get better and better and better based on what you asked for. So what is this? First of all, it is a free hypervisor. It is Hyper-V. It is the real bits. Now you'll notice, look at that gorgeous command line. Have you ever seen a command line that looked as beautiful as that? That's the interface, boys and girls. That's it. Okay? Now let me be very clear. This is where everybody goes, aha, that's it. He's going to make me buy System Center, right? No. You can manage this with our free remote server administration tools. It's been free for years. I know the other guys are out there saying, no, Microsoft has got some hook or some catch. I'm here to tell you, it really is free. It is the real hypervisor. It does not include any guests. So let me be very clear. You don't get unlimited copies of Windows. This is not Windows Server. This is just the hypervisor. But if you want to run Linux, guess what? You can run Windows Server and Windows VMs. You can run Hyper-V Server and Linux VMs. And guess what? You can manage it all from System Center because it manages all these platforms. In addition, I'm going to say it again, it is a free ISO. You can download from Microsoft.com. It's designed for remote management. So when I say, look at that beautiful command line, I'm actually not kidding. That is a beautiful command line because that's the way you should be managing servers in the first place. Okay? How many times have I talked to a customer and I find out they're having all these weird problems on their servers and they're doing all sorts of things on their servers that they shouldn't be doing in the first place? I'm not kidding. I was just at TechEd Orlando and I was talking with a customer who basically said, yeah, we just bought another company. I'm looking at their IT and they've been doing all sorts of bizarre things. And I said, well, give me an example. He's like, they're running QuickBooks on domain controllers. I said, you'll have to pardon me, sir. I'm going to need to sit down. And that was just the tip of the iceberg. Hyper-V Server is designed to be managed remotely. So that's what you get. The goal here is quite simply, you want to join the domain, add your administrator account. You can configure whether you want to use Windows Update or you want to update through another mechanism. You basically configure all of the box, and then you manage it remotely. So why would I use this? Number one, VM consolidation of Linux. Number two, VDI. So think about this. If you're thinking about doing a VDI deployment, certainly Windows Server is an awesome solution for it. But if you're buying Windows Server, you're buying it to get server licenses. You actually don't In a VDI environment, you need client licenses. If you use Hyper-V Server, it's perfect. You get the hypervisor. It's completely free, has all the capabilities, all the performance, everything you're looking for, and you just put your VMs on top of that. And then finally, for hosters. For hosters that want to be able to manage all sorts of different platforms, this way you can manage Linux, do it in a holistic way, using System Center, using PowerShell, using your own tools, doesn't matter, because our APIs are wide open, but you can manage Hyper-V Server and you can manage Windows Server because we use a consistent set of APIs across Hyper-V. So I had to put this next two slides in here because, I just mentioned this in recently. This just information is starting to come out. And the questions are, people can't believe this. So is this an evaluation version? Is there activation? No. And no. This is an enterprise-class hypervisor for everyone. Is this supported in production? Yes, it has been since day one for many years now. Does Hyper-V Server have reduced or limited scale? No. I'll get to that in just a minute. Is System Center required for live migration or live storage migration? No. Think about that for a second. We are giving you live migration and live storage migration. The other guys, well, you know what they cost. This is all in the box. And you can manage this using the free RSAT tools, System Center, or PowerShell, or write your own. What else? Is clustering included with Hyper-V Server 2012? Yes, it actually has been for many years now, starting with Hyper-V Server 2008 R2. Does Hyper-V Server include live migration? Yes. Does Hyper-V include shared nothing live migration? Oh my gosh, yes. Does this include the new extensible switch? Yes. Does this include replica? Lots more yes. Anybody intrigued by this at all? So here's just a short list, and this is not even close to being the complete list. But just to show you how much we've delivered between Server 2008 R2 and 2012. And the point I want to make is this is customer-driven. More features, more scale, more availability, more mobility in each release. While the other guys have been taking their free product and making it worse every time, we've been taking our free product and making it better every time. And guess what? A lot of people, while Hyper-V Server is not very well known, people are definitely hearing about it because we're now seeing over 12,000 downloads a month of Hyper-V Server. And we've been seeing this for a very long time. So clearly people are getting the word, even though we're not actually talking about it a great deal. So there's the inevitable. So I'm going to be nice, and I'm going to compare just the free versions. Okay? I think that's an apples-to-apples comparison, and I'm not going to pile on here. So we're going to compare the free version of ESX and the free version of Hyper-V. All right? Scale. They're limited to 4 CPUs in a VM. Their host is limited to 32 gigs. That's as much as you can put in the machine, or is supported by ESX free. No enterprise features, no vMotion, no storage vMotion, no HA, no extensible switch, no VM replication, just lots of no, okay? Hyper-V Server 2012, scale, 64 virtual processors per VM, up to 4 terabytes of memory per server, up to 1 terabyte of memory per VM, enterprise level features included. Shared nothing live migrate. Yeah, start taking pictures now. I'll get out of the way. don't want to impede anyone. Live storage migration, high availability via clustering, replica, storage spaces, Windows NIC teaming, the extensible switch, offloaded data transfer. It's all here. Any more pictures? Just want to make sure. I always want to make sure I'm one more in the back. Thank you. All right, so this leads to the inevitable question. So, I got this really expensive stuff over here, Jeff, and Any chance you could make it easy for me to convert it to Hyper-V 2012? We're announcing the Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter Beta. Long overdue, it's here. And let me show you very quickly what it's designed to do. First of all, it's tiny. It's 4 megabytes. Megabytes. Very small. The whole goal is to provide you a simple and easy tool that you can download, low-risk option, to help you easily convert your VMs. And it's not disks. I want to be very clear. It's the entire VM. Converting disks is actually easy. It's just an image conversion, okay? Converting VMs is where you actually look at the configuration, make sure you're looking at all the number of processors, the number of NICs, the amount of memory, and packaging up the whole thing along with the disk and converting everything. In addition, we'll uninstall the VMware tools and we'll install the Hyper-V integration services. And we have it as an easy-to-use wizard GUI to walk you right through it. In fact, let me show you what it looks like. Step one, select your ESX server or your vCenter server. If you select an ESX or vCenter server, it's going to give you a list of VMs. Type in the IP address, your username and password. It'll give you a list of VMs. Select your VM to convert. It'll ask you, what do you want to happen with the source? Do you want to leave it running? Do you want to turn it off after it's converted? Do you want to start it up on the target machine? Or do you want to just put it do you want to leave it off? You choose. You select a temporary folder. Type in a username and password because we're going to be installing integration services for you. You can choose the type of VHD that it's converted to. Is it a fixed disk or a dynamic disk? And guess what? You're done. Now, you'll get this warning. In fact, you'll get this warning every single time because the folks at VMware seem to think that floppy disks are cool. We haven't used floppy disk, well, ever on Hyper-V. Virtual floppies, that's really cool in 1998. VMware likes to use virtual floppies, so we just ignore virtual floppies, so just to give you that. And then you'll click on Finish, and it'll go through a process, and it's done. And how long it takes really depends on how big the disk is, how fast the storage is you have, but eventually you end up with a complete virtual machine that you can run in Hyper-V. The converter beta, currently right now, works with vSphere 4.1 and vSphere 5. It converts today to Server 2008 and Windows Server 2008 R2 and Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2008 R2 SP1. The current beta as of today doesn't support Server 2012. You can expect that's about to change very, very soon. And it's available right here. So I will again get out of the way for people that like to take pictures. These slides will be available, so you can always download these as well. But that's where you can and should download the current Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter Beta. It'll be freely available, easy to use, less than 4 megabytes. There you go. So, Server 2012, comprehensive and deep. When we think cloud, it's more than the virtualization layer. Yes, I've focused on Hyper-V, but we've done a tremendous amount in storage, in networking, in automation, in replication, in extensibility, in manageability, you name it. It's all there. Nothing from Microsoft, and I mean literally nothing, has ever been this ambitious from Jason Perlow at ZDNet. Hundreds of thousands of downloads of the beta. Our TAP customers, I'll be honest with you, one of the questions I get asked all the time is, Jeff, this sounds really, really good. Here's a tough question for you. What's the biggest problem that you've had with Windows Server 2012? And be honest, what's the biggest problem you've had since Server 2012? And I said, that's an easy one. The biggest problem we've had since Server 2012 is since the beta got out and we've had people downloading it, we've had more people, I've had people calling us up, requesting and trying to demand us to support them in production right now because it's that good. And there's a reason why we've been running it in production for a very, very long time. It's really, really a fantastic release. So, Server 2012, the definitive cloud OS, designed for mission-critical scale-up, storage options galore, whether it's fiber, whether it's SMB, whether it's VHDX, all sorts of storage options. High availability throughout the entire stack. PowerShell automation engine is built entirely through Windows Server, and everything that you saw me do in Hyper-V is automatable through PowerShell. Microsoft Hyper-V Server, completely free, and it's the complete feature set. The RC is available now, and the Virtual Machine Converter beta is available now. Just a reminder, a couple things. I didn't get a chance to talk about Replica. So if you want, make sure you go to VIR 302. We'll do a deep dive on enabling disaster recovery using Hyper-V Replica. Also, VIR 303, an overview of Hyper-V networking in Windows Server 2012. And again, we have a deep dive into Hyper-V storage with one of our program managers, Senthil. That's coming up later today as well. We also have the hands-on lab. So if you want to actually play with Replica, configure VM replication, you can do that here in the hands-on labs. Please come by the server booth. We'd love to talk to you about Hyper-V if you have any additional questions. Get your private cloud certification. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at WSVGuy. Just to let you know, I don't tweet a lot. I'm not one of those guys that needs to tell you what I'm having for breakfast. I don't get that at all. What I generally tweet is information that's coming out, new information, pointing to blog posts. So I promise I won't fill up your Twitter box with it, okay? Thank you very, very much. Enjoy the rest of your time at TechEd.